in and of itself.
Yes.
But he cannot marry a non-Muslim woman as long as he has a Muslim woman already, yes, a permanent Muslim wife. He cannot, even if that Muslim wife is a temporary Muslim wife, but he cannot marry at the same time, get married at the same time to a non-Muslim woman. Okay, uh-huh. So we should. That's very important.
So a non-Muslim wife is off limit whatsoever.
Yes, it's not permissible in the presence of a Muslim wife.
Right.
He cannot marry a non-Muslim woman or a non-Muslim girl at all under any circumstances.
But if there is no Muslim wife, you mean, is that a possibility or permissibility? Is there permissibility for the Muslim man, in fact, to marry a non-Muslim woman?
If he's married and
if he's not married.
If he's not married, of course, it is permissible to contract temporary marriage to him.
But not permanent.
Not permanent. Permanent, yes, marriage is not permissible.
That's a principle.
According to
law.
All religious authorities. According, right, to all religious authorities, permanent marriage is not allowed to a non-Muslim woman.
Right.
Okay. But as for a Muslim woman is concerned, of course, it's permissible to marry temporarily or permanently with or without permission of her, of his wife.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
And our dear audience do understand that, you know, we are talking about Islamic laws and we are looking at the matrimony,
yes,
between a husband and his wife and what can come with the territory. And when we are talking about, in fact, this kind of permissibility, as you rightly mentioned or nicely put, we are talking about the Islamic laws, not as you mentioned, we are not talking about the emotional aspect of the,
yes,
situation or even what the law, in fact, requires every citizen of each and every country to do, right?
Yes,
the Islamic laws may be different in such scenarios, right?
Yeah.
We are talking about Islamic laws, not the legal, for example, stipulation that in some countries that does not allow, for example, bigamy,
sure,
or polygamy, right?
Polygamy, yes.
Yes.
So, of course, permissibility is one thing, but the norm is something else. In some countries, okay, Islam allows, okay?
Yes.
Theoretically speaking, it is permissible, but practically many men cannot get married because they are afraid of damaging or destroying their permanent relationship or their permanent marriage.
Yes.
Okay? And that's going. That's a negative consequence of marrying another woman. If the permanent wife comes to know that her husband is getting married to another woman, she feels that she has been betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Betrayed.
Yes.
And therefore, she might start actually retaliating on her husband or doing something which will permanently affect their relationship.
Yes, and if there is this risk that the husband would fear that he would lose his wife,
yes,
or this affair that he's going to have with another woman in addition to his permanent wife,
yes,
if that leads to a kind of would-be divorce, is it still permissible for the man to get married, either temporarily or permanently?
Yeah, Ayatollah Sistani discourages. Okay, he says that he should not take action for this marriage, because saving the marriage, first marriage, is more important than getting another wife.
Yes, true indeed.
Yes.
Okay, a very quick question regarding Shia man. Is it possible or is it permissible according to Islamic laws by Ayatollah Sistani for a Shia man to contract a temporary marriage to a Sunni woman?
Of course, according to Ahlus Sunnah, because this is their belief, they do not believe in the validity of temporary marriage, and of course they have their own argument or evidence whatsoever. It is permissible according to Shia scholars and according to Shia jurists to get married to a Sunni woman, whether permanently or temporarily. But one should make sure that the Sunni wife is not going to mislead him in the process of getting married, or she does not stipulate that her husband actually changes his belief or his religious dogma in one sense or the other. If there is such a stipulation, or if it is feared that he might, the husband might get misled or get astray, then it's not permissible to get married. Otherwise, it's permissible.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim La ilaha illa hu Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir
Friday, the United States imposed sanctions on chairman of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Faleh al-Fayyad, accusing him of human rights abuses during anti-government demonstrations in the Arab country in late 2019. Iraq's foreign ministry slammed as unacceptable the U.S. Treasury Department's blacklisting of the 64-year-old. The ministry said it will carefully pursue all decisions made by the Treasury against Iraqi figures during both the current and the incoming U.S. administrations and will attempt to address the ramifications. Meanwhile, the leader of the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq also issued a statement strongly denouncing the new U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of his country's sovereignty. The move also drew condemnations from Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movements. In a statement, Hezbollah said the new sanctions are the latest entry in the list of U.S. crimes against the Iraqi government and people, while Ansarullah deemed the sanctions as another sign of Washington's animosity toward the Arab nation.
So when the United States now sees that the Ashqal Sha'abi, the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, are, even though they are led by an established politician, a well-respected political leader with a long state of service that is now the chairman of the Hashd al-Sha'abi, despite all of this, the United States will still consider this person to be a potential threat. However, from the perspective of the United States, the U.S. imperialist perspective, the Hashd al-Sha'abi presents a domestic and a homegrown purely Iraqi domestic resistance against terrorism, but also against imperialism, against foreign hegemony, and against, you know, attempts to overtake the country and to make Iraq into a puppet state, as it sort of was in the first few years after the 2003 invasion.
The Ansarullah movement voiced confidence that the sanctions would not affect the Iraqi people's will to free their homeland and drive the occupying forces out of their country. The PMU celebrated its leader being hit by U.S. sanctions, saying it's an honor for the Iraqi official to be viewed as one of Washington's enemies, alongside Iran and Iraq's top commanders who were assassinated in a drone strike ordered by President Donald Trump. The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. The Iraqi parliament voted to integrate the PMU into the Iraqi military in 2016, effectively placing the force under the command of Prime Minister and granting the group a standing similar to that of other branches of Iraqi security forces. But even that hasn't kept the U.S. from putting extra pressure on the group, similar to any other forces that stand against Washington's hegemony in the region.
Indeed, despite the fact that the United States, they talk a lot about the war on terror ever since the Bush era, but in reality we have seen that the United States arms and supports terrorist organizations all over the globe. This goes from Colombian drug lords to Salafi, Wahhabi, Takfiri gangs in Iraq, to ethnic supremacists trying to break apart the nations of Iran and Pakistan, for example. This is a global campaign of support to real terrorists, and at the same time, a campaign of targeting, assassinating, and attacking, slandering, and trying to imprison people who actually fight against these terrorists.
But the U.S. actions against the resistance in the region are provoking their correspondent reactions. Anti-U.S. sentiment in West Asia is on the rise, with more people calling for the ouster of U.S. from West Asia by the day.
What the world saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S., violence that steadily intensified and featured the direct incitements of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They are often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups, who often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. Five people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. You look at the numbers of people who were rioters who worked their way into the Capitol. This is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists, we saw racist groups, we saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened to the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warrant his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment, but the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That too is politically complicated and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the vice president who was working his way around the president, actually excluding the president from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that a U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. president's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the US. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major US towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting the huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the US government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the US, not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behaviour demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognising when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily, if you like, recognizable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's, you know, 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, again, Abdulhamid points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are, I think, are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counterterrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud, and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched through the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump and Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos exposed internal collapse in the American political system and that the events showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill. And, you know, we profess to be the bastion of democracy. But the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so what I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years. But that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
While China has landed a spacecraft on the moon 3 times in the last 7 years, NASA has not landed there since 1972, the last Apollo mission. That could change in 2021, deepening the commercial transformation of American space efforts. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article authored by Michael Roston entitled Missions to Mars, Moon and Beyond Await Earth in 2021. This article was published on the New York Times. Stay tuned. About a month after the new Christian year has started on Earth, 3 spacecraft will put into the vicinity of Mars. These explorers, which launched in July last year, will herald of a busy year of space exploration, launches, and astronomical occurrences. What follows is a preview of some of 2021's most notable expected events. Private companies and the world's space agencies are likely to announce more. The United Arab Emirates, China, and the United States all launched robotic missions to Mars last summer, seeking shortened voyages during the period every 2 years when Earth is closest to the red planet. The three spacecraft will join a bustling community of explorers either in orbit or on the planet's surface. The first to arrive will be Emirati Hope Orbiter, the first deep space explorer of the Arab country's small space program. The mission will study the Martian atmosphere, sending valuable data back to scientists on Earth. It is to reach its destination on February 9th. China's Tianwen-1 mission is also to arrive at Mars on February 10th. After orbiting the planet for a time, it will send a lander containing a rover to the surface in May. Landing intact on the solar system's fourth planet is perilous, and only NASA has done it more than once. A successful landing there would extend China's record of impressive space flight achievements, especially after last year's Chang'e E-5 mission to the lunar surface, then back to Earth with a fresh cache of moon rocks. Soon after, on February 18, NASA's Perseverance rover will arrive and immediately plunge toward the surface of Mars. If it lands successfully, the rover will seek signs of extinct life in a dried-out crater lake and riverbed. But first, it will deploy Ingenuity, a small helicopter. That device has its own mission of carrying out the first powered flight from the surface of another planet. While China has landed a spacecraft on the moon 3 times in the last 7 years, NASA has not landed there since 1972. The last Apollo mission that would change in 2021, deepening the commercial transformation of American space efforts. NASA has in the past decade relied on private companies to build and operate spacecraft that could ferry cargo and now people to the International Space Station, ISS. It is trying a similar approach with commercial lunar payload services. The program has contracted with a number of private companies to build robotic lunar landers that will carry cargo from NASA and other customers to the moon surface. The first company, Pittsburgh Astrobotic, is scheduled to launch its Pergamon lander to the moon in June. It could be followed in October by Nova C, a spacecraft built by Initiative Machines of Houston. NASA also has its eye on returning astronauts to the moon this decade. Its first step will be an uncrewed test flight of the massive space launch system built for future American deep space launches. The rocket has faced numerous delays and ballooning costs, but NASA still plans a journey in 2021 known as Artemis 1. It will send Orion, a capsule for astronauts, around the moon and back to Earth. That test is tentatively scheduled for November. Deeper into the deep space, the most significantly and scientifically important mission of 2021 has been a long time coming. The launch of James Webb Space Telescope, effectively a successor to the Hubble telescope, has been postponed for years, plagued by technical problems and mounting costs. NASA and the world's astronomers and planetary scientists are eager to see it get off the ground at the end of October. The agency settled on that time frame after coronavirus pandemic and other problems added another delay to the existing schedule. Two other NASA explorers will also head out into the solar system. The double asteroid redirection test spacecraft, launching in July, aims to test whether a spacecraft could deflect a future asteroid that was headed toward Earth's surface. To do that, it will visit Deimos, a pair of near-Earth asteroids that travel around the Sun together an attempt, a collision, to notch the orbit of the smaller rock. A second mission, Lucy, will launch in October and travel much farther, making flybys through Jupiter's orbital path. There will be another study, the Trojans, asteroids that travel in the same orbit as Jupiter, but hundreds of millions of miles ahead or beyond, trapped there by the giant planet's gravity. Scientists think these space rockets could conceal secrets of how the solar system's outer planets are formed. Human spaceflight was transformed in 2020 as SpaceX successfully launched a pair of crews to the space station. The company is likely to send more astronauts to orbit in 2021, and not all of them may be working for NASA and other governmental space agencies. Multiple companies are working with SpaceX to launch paying customers on the Crew Dragon capsule. One of them, Axiom Space, could send its first private tourists to the space station late in the year. When NASA picked SpaceX to build transport for its astronauts, it also hired Boeing to do the same. During an uncrewed test to orbit in December 2019, a series of errors nearly led to the catastrophic loss of Boeing's Starliner capsule. To make up for that unsuccessful flight, Boeing will carry out a second test flight as early as March. Other human journeys to the space also beckon this year. Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin may send paying customers on short trips to the edge of space and back in 2021. China could also start launching pieces of its next-generation space station during the year, setting it on a course to have a regular human presence in low Earth orbit in the years to come. If 2020 taught people anything, it was to expect the unexpected. While COVID-19 darkened the world as it traveled around the sun, humanity was surprised by views of comet Neowise in the summer month and enthralled with the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn during the winter solstice. It's a big universe, and there's so much of it to be seen from our smaller part of it. A lunar eclipse on May 26th will overlap with a period when the moon is closer to Earth than usual, what some call a super blood moon. People in Australia and on Pacific Islands, as well as in Western United States, will get the best views of the occurrence. And some of the event will be visible in other parts of the Americas, as well as East and South Asia. Most people in North America will have to wait until 2024 to experience the next total solar eclipse, like the one in August 2017. But on June 10th, some North Americans will get a taste of what's to come in 3 years, when an annular solar eclipse darkens some skies. Also known as a ring of fire eclipse, it happens when the moon is too far from Earth to fully obstruct the sun, leaving a halo of sunlight around its edges. This unusual eclipse will cross over the North Pole as it travels, and only people in small parts of Canada and Russia will get the full effect. But those willing to wake early enough on parts of the East Coast and wear their safety glasses will get to see a partial eclipse around sunrise that morning.
The existence of the Balhaf prison was first announced by the United Nations in September 2019. 2 months later, Armaments Observatory released a detailed report about the facility, which the Emiratis had turned into a military base and a secret prison.
The fact that they've taken over a gas plant essential for the country's energy supply and for its economy and turned it into a detention camp where torture is being reportedly carried on is an indication of just the brutality of this occupation force in Yemen.
Based on witness accounts, the report also accused Emirati soldiers of treating prisoners inhumanely. The UAE had already been accused of running a secret network of prisons across Yemen.
But I think having prisons in other countries, particularly in Yemen, it's difficult to tell what's happening in Yemen because there's a war. So, I mean, it's much easier to hide political prisoners, torture. It's more difficult for human rights agencies to tell what exactly is happening, and it's much easier for the authorities and the occupation forces to deny that these abuses are taking place. So I think having a detention center in Yemen is advantageous for the United Arab Emirates in that sense. Remember that the United Arab Emirates is a country that presents its image of itself as a modernizing country. It's highly invested in technology, and Dubai is a major city in the world, a major modern city, so it would not work to have this kind of brutality on its own shores.
But what made the story strange was the awkward silence of France since the revelation. Given that Total SE, a French multinational oil and gas company, was the biggest shareholder with nearly 40% of stakes, critics said the silence was significant. Recently, the French Parliament has called on Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian to answer questions about the alleged existence of a UAE-built military base and detention center in the vicinity of Balhaf. French lawmaker Clémentine Autain has accused Emmanuel Macron's government of covering up crimes committed by the UAE at Balhaf. The fact is, the UAE has gradually become a crucial partner for France. In the words of French historian Sébastien Nadot, despite their small size and low profile, the Emiratis play a key role in France's international strategy. A rich federation with a big appetite for arms purchase, the UAE is worth enough for the French to look the other way when the Emiratis are violating human rights at Balhaf or anywhere else. In fact, France's silence could be explained by its lucrative partnership with Abu Dhabi, especially in military cooperation and arms trade.
United Arab Emirates, of course, have been relying on French technology. They have the tanks, Leclerc tanks, and Mirage planes, which they've been supplied with by the French. The French continue to maintain those military technologies that they're using, that equipment that they're using, and of course that is a key to their to the war, because the equipment, most of it, is being bought in the West, in particularly in France. And so the French are heavily involved in this whole scenario here, where essentially the country's energy supply is now, its major energy plant is now being used as a torture and a prison center.
Despite public outrage, arms deals have been getting bigger over the past decade between Paris and Abu Dhabi, according to the 2020 report to Parliament on arms exports. The first French multi-service military base in the Middle East is located in Abu Dhabi, housing around 700 military personnel. The base includes an air base, a naval base capable of receiving a French aircraft carrier, and an army base.
Well, since 2010, under Nicolas Sarkozy, President Sarkozy, the French have upped their investment in Arab countries, in particular the United Arab Emirates. They even have a military base in the United Arab Emirates. So they have been very much involved in supplying and modernizing the United Arab Emirates their military technology. And so that is the main reason. I mean, that partnership is quite extensive and quite deep. They've even allowed the United Arab Emirates to have major exports. Paintings, for example, have been exported temporarily to United Arab Emirates in exchange for continued military contracts. So these military contracts are extremely important for France. I already mentioned Mirage planes, Leclerc tanks, and many more, much more technology. This is a multi-billion dollar industry.
According to Emma Sobriere, for France, a presence in the UAE is strategic and will allow easy intervention to prevent possible disturbances affecting access to Gulf oil. Abu Dhabi is visibly formulating a regional strategy of influence with a focus on the creation of commercial and military port facilities stretching from the Horn of Africa to the Mediterranean. Given the military background of Emirati Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, the French have little, if any, doubt that the UAE will continue signing big arms deals with them. According to Jalal Harchawi of Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, in general, Paris does not want to strike any false note that might spoil its intimate friendship with Abu Dhabi, believing that this symbiotic relationship will, in the years to come, always lead to success.
The idea that France supports human rights and that it has concern for human rights is really a myth. The human rights discourse is really part of the foreign policy agenda of the French. It's about presenting a positive image of France as a moral order, as a moral power, when in reality they have never been interested in human rights. The main interest is in power projection and economic exchange and exploitation, in particular, of developing countries. And the Gulf states allied with Israel and the West are key to that agenda.
Located on the Gulf of Aden coast in the southern part of Yemen, Belhaf mirrors the inhumanity of the Emiratis, who have turned Yemen's major source of income into a secret, macabre prison, and the greed of the French, who seem to have preferred petrodollars to anything else in the world.
Ocean of Dua.
ثم إني أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa
Dear listeners, in the previous program, we had a kind of illustration of the state of yearning towards the Almighty Allah. Here is another illustration of the yearning toward Allah in the whispered prayer of Arifin, which is called the Knowers, by Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. He starts saying, O Allah, make us among those within the gardens of whose breasts the trees of yearning for you have taken firm root, and the assemblies of whose hearts have been seized by the ardor of your love. They seek shelter in the nests of meditation, feed upon the gardens of nearness and disclosure, drink from the pools of love with the cup of gentle favor, and enter into the watering places of warm affection. Now let's have a quick and brief explanation of this phrase by Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. He says, make us among those within the gardens of whose breasts the trees of yearning for you have taken firm root. The breasts of the friends of the Almighty Allah, as it appears from the speech of the Imam, are the gardens of delight containing delicious fruits. And generally, the breasts of the people are of different kinds. Some breasts are libraries and schools of learning. Of course, knowledge is good and light. It is Nur itself. Of course, if the breast remains a garden of yearning toward Almighty Allah.
Alhamdulillah, Khaliq al-Khalq, Basit al-Rizq, Faliq al-Asbah, Dhil Jalal wal-Ikram, والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
Some other breasts are like shops. They're like banks. They're like markets, crowded with numbers and tables and charts and the accounts of profit and loss. Wealth and trade are good, but with the condition that they should not become activities which occupy the heart and the breast of the person. These things should not become the person's only concern. And there are breasts which are similar to salty lands in that they produce nothing but thorns, poison, tussle. They produce deceit and plots against the others. There are also the breasts which are places of entertainment and playgrounds, the way this world is a play and diversion for a large number of people. This is called dunya. But as for the friends of the Almighty Allah, the Awliyaullah, their breasts are gardens of yearning, as put by Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, filled with joy, delightful fruits, and wherein the trees of yearning have taken firm root. So the yearning toward Allah is not something extrinsic to their breasts, such that it would disappear under the compulsion of their lowly desires, or in case this world were to glamorize itself for them. Nor would it diminish or its leaves wilt if this world were to cause constraint over them, or they were encircled by its hardships, because the trees of Shauq are firmly rooted in these breasts. So they remain leafy, verdant, and fruitful despite all the obstacles, difficulties, and hardships they face. The state of yearning is in fact the state of the lightness of the soul, a state contrary to that of heaviness, and being inclined towards this world, which is referred to in this holy verse. The Holy Quran says, "What is the matter with you, that when you are told, go forth in the way of Allah, you sink heavily to the ground?" The Holy Quran says, إِذَا قَلْتُمْ إِلَى الْأَرْضِ, are you pleased with the life of this world instead of the hereafter? Indeed, the soul becomes burdensome and sometimes gets someone attached to this world and gets pleased with it. But in contrast, if one is freed from this world, and he somehow manages to pluck himself out, he would become spiritually light, and subsequently he is easily attracted to the love of Allah and yearning toward Him.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab anjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab anjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Anyway, dear listeners, this much of the discussion and illustrations of love and shawq and intimacy from our supplications of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam seems to be enough, and in the later program we'll manage to take up another discussion regarding the love of the Almighty Allah. So stay with us. Thank you for being with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.